Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is a Wednesday afternoon, and the Wintrust Business Lunch is some showers and storms, but not in the studio because Terry Savage is sitting to my right, and she just always brings sunshine with her.
Oh, well, little sunshine. Fed Watch. Ding, 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 ding.
It's what we do, right?
Less it seems than an like hour.
Every 3 weeks, we start revving up about what the Fed is or isn't going to do. And most people think that, you know, today when they make their announcement that they're not going to raise interest rates, but why would they? I mean, is there...
Now, there you've got the $64 trillion question, because that's probably the amount of the U.S. debt and other debt that will be impacted around the world by a Fed rate increase. Why would the Fed want to raise interest rates? And I'll give you my take on this. It's because the current low rates, which have done really nothing to make this economy rev up, are living proof that these unelected representatives, bankers, philosophers, quasi-economists have no idea what they're doing.
Okay.
And low interest rates have proved around the world that they are incapable of, at this point anyway, jump-starting growth, jump-starting inflation. All you have to do is forget Europe, which the European Central Bank is buying up all this debt, putting money in the economy. The rates are negative, and people are going, well, I'm not going to pay the bank to put it in the bank. I'll just sit on it under my mattress. But where that really happened is Japan, which has had negative rates for quite a while. There's $10 trillion, by the way, of central bank debt trading at negative yields. One-third of all the central bank debt out there has negative yields. In Japan, think about this. Take yourself out of America. You're in Japan. If you put money in the bank, you're in effect paying the bank to hold it.
Right.
So what do? You put literally cash in the mattress. It slows the economy down, and Japan's experiment with negative interest rates has not worked.
But
in fact, last night they kind of acknowledged that with their going forward plans. So they're not pushing rates more negative. So the fact is, the Fed knows that negative interest rates or low interest rates here do only one thing. Pretty significant, though. It helps the U.S. government finance its debt at a very low cost.
We could use that.
It hasn't helped the economy a bit.
But if you raise interest rates, it could hurt the economy.
Exactly. But what they would like to do is get some breathing room, have rates be more normal and higher, so that when and if we get into another economic slowdown, they could go revert to their old trick of cutting interest rates to get the economy going.
So they would jack up rates now, not because it would help us, but because it would prepare us for the next time things go south.
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
But banks need higher interest. There's some arguments for higher rates. Well, savers, how about all of us?
Right.
Money in the bank, zero. But banks need higher rates so they can make the spread between what they pay savers and lend to borrowers. So that would help the banking industry, which would help them make loans, which might grow the economy. You can make a few arguments for higher interest rates, the grandmother argument, savers, my chicken money, and the banks. But the fact is, the last time they even hinted that they were close, the stock market just crashed. You know, eventually, rates are going up unless we swirl down into a recession.
Okay, so who suffers with higher rates? And I asked that because I was reading, I think it was on Market Watch earlier today. I don't know who they cited, but 92 million people are holding various debt instruments with interest rates that depend on what the Fed does. If they raise it a quarter of a point, the average impact would be $6 a month.
Yeah, well,
that's not much
in a macro sense. But okay, well, who would suffer? If you have an adjustable rate mortgage, it will adjust up a little bit.
A quarter percent.
If you have a balloon mortgage, though, and the perception is that the trend is in rates is rising, and your balloon comes to the end of 10 years, a lot of people had those balloons 10 years ago before the crash, then you might find yourself refinancing at a higher rate. Your credit card rates could barely go any higher, right? So
right.
Let's not talk about that. Higher interest rates, if it really sent... We have a weak economy. The jobs... I mean, it's okay, it's positive, but it's not growing strongly. We'll be lucky to get 1% GDP growth in the third quarter, unlike the 4 or 5% we used to get before a decade or so ago. So if rates go up, it might make businesses hesitant to expand. It might make them feel like consumers aren't going to ready to buy, and it could impact the entire jobs market. That's a great fear.
Okay.
Higher rates slow the economy. That's traditionally what they're meant to do.
Let me ask you... a question that will just show my lack of knowledge here, but so they're meeting.
What if I don't know the answer to
this? Oh, you will know the answer to this. So they're meeting today for the second date. By this point, it's cooked, right? They know what they're going to do.
Oh, they know what they're going to do.
Do they do it by a show of hands? Do they do
Well, they are typically unanimous. The minutes come out. The last time I think that there was
how can
dissent,
they be unanimous if we heard the well, very
okay,
ideas?
So this is what's really, this is called collegiality, or right. Or A, I don't know if I could say this, or B, a bunch of old farts who decide nobody wants to be an outlier. It's been since the early 1990s when Wayne Angel, who was a good Chicago friend, used to be on the Executives Club forecast luncheon after he left the Fed. It's been since the early 1990s that a rate decision has been made that where there was somebody who publicly dissented. So collegiality, it's not like the Supreme Court where you get a 4-3 decision.
Right. Okay, I get that. So when they announce it,
they'll say
say it was unanimous. Okay.
They'll show later on, not so later on. They'll release the minutes that showed who dissented and who voted strongly against it. But in the end, the likelihood is that if they're going to raise rates, they will do it unanimously.
They'll announce it unanimously.
Announce it was a unanimous vote. It'll be interesting to see if anyone dissents.
But is it one person, one vote? Is it a simple majority rule?
Yes. Right. The Open Market Committee, yeah.
Okay, and so what's going to happen?
Oh, you know, a couple...
An hour from now, we'll...
Okay,
I feel like I'm doing countdown, like on CNN, to the presidential debate.
Exactly. The odds are strongly... Just forget me making odds, Terry Savage. The futures markets and everything else are telling you they're not going to do it this time. And the three reasons are they're not going to do it this time because, number one, the economy isn't strong enough. And number two, it's before a presidential election. And number three, they don't know what they're doing and they don't want to make a big mistake and crash the market.
And so, it would be a little bit of a shocker if they did.
It would be a huge shocker. A couple of analysts, street people who have said, yeah, they're going to raise rates. So everybody will forget they were wrong. But if those three guys, if they happen to raise rates and it's like a 1 in 7 chance on the futures markets, then those will be, oh, you knew it. You knew it. But so we're not talking about what they do in terms of raising rates. We're talking about what Janet Yellen says at 1:30 Chicago time about the warning that they might do it in December. And the language that she uses in explaining why there may or may not be, but maybe people are wondering if she will say, we're going to do it in December. We're getting very close to doing it in December. That'll be after the election. That'll be at the year end. And what counts most likely is going to be the interpretation of her words.
That's Terry Savage. We're going to take a break, come back, and then Terry's got some ideas about how to get creditors off your back for the elderly, right?
For the elderly. This is, please, if you may not be a senior who's a debtor or a disabled person who's a debtor, but I bet you know someone who is. I think this is the most wonderful story. Strange for me to write it, though.
Yeah, I know. I agree. We'll kick that around in a minute. It's 12:23. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch Wednesday afternoon. Steve Bertrand in on 720 WGN. Terry Savage as well. You can read Terry Savage's columns. They're on the Huffington Post, but I usually go to...
Tribune website.
I always go to...
And TerrySavage.com.
Well, I was going to say, that's where I usually go.
Good.
And
get
the little newsletters and things. And so you've got this column about people who are senior citizens who are debtors and who are a way to escape the... Now, you're about paying your bills. This is not
that's
you.
That's the thing. So this is not typically me. You know, I've spent years telling you how to pay down your credit cards, what the trick is. I've spent years telling you to go to...
333, right?
Yeah. Is it 333? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have years telling you the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, 800-388-2227. You can find it at terrysavage.com. It's right on the top there. So that if you're working, you don't want your wages garnished. You don't want your lien attached to your home. And you don't want the sense of defaulting. So there's help. They get the fees waived and the interest rates lowered. And it can help you be on a payment plan. So I spent my whole life talking about that. And then something struck me. There's a wonderful guy in Chicago, an attorney named Jerry Lamette, who told me about this a few years ago. And this is all in a column at TerrySavage.com. He set up something called Debt Counsel for Seniors and the Disabled. He's been doing it for almost 20 years.
Oh, so he created it.
Now, He created this. Now think about, I mean, he uses the federal laws, but just think about this. It's one thing for me to tell you make a double payment on your credit card and you'll get out and so forth. What if you're a senior, you're living on Social Security or a government pension or a pension, a small pension, or you're disabled, you live on government benefits. The inflation, as we just saw for seniors for medical care, has been the only inflation that's around. And sometimes seniors have to choose between rent or food and things that aren't covered by Medicare. And so they pile it up on their credit cards or other medical debt or whatever. So Debt Council for Seniors and Disabled, which is the website is debtcouncil.net.
I just posted it on my Facebook page.
Okay, good. And it's on Terry Savage right there. Is a simple solution that uses the National the Fair Credit Collection Practices Act, which says that you can't harass someone once they have told you that a lawyer is representing you.
So the idea is these people who have no means to pay deal with the phone calls that come in, and they're, you know, they're, I get, you know, you get calls from people. I don't get calls from creditors,
I get calls from all kinds of things, and I know just to hang up.
But it's a little frightening sometimes.
Everything Debt Council for Seniors and the Disabled does, you can do yourself, but if you're 88 and you're old and you're scared,
right,
you don't do this. So here's the law says that after five years in Illinois, 4 years in some states, six in others, if you haven't paid a debt, it becomes uncollectible. So the trick is, and I never thought you'd hear this coming out of my mouth, but this is only for seniors and the disabled who cannot go out and get another job and pay it off. If you don't respond, if you don't affirm the debt, if you don't make a payment on it, even though it's been sold to a collector, after 5 years, it is officially uncollectible. And if they threaten to sue you, you could report them to the attorney general. So what DebtCouncil.net does, and they're here in Chicago, is they charge you a setup fee of $125 to $250, depending on the amount of debt, and probably a fee of about $25, $35 a month. When you get these calls, you tell them, I'm represented by counsel. First, you say, give me your name and address and phone number, like you're going to pay him.
Uh-huh.
And then you say, I'm represented by counsel. You report that back to the lawyers, and they tell them you're represented by counsel, and they must contact the lawyer.
So they can't
contact. They field the calls. Exactly.
Right.
It takes the burden off. Now, seniors don't want to go bankrupt. It's not only the expense, it's very public, a filing of bankruptcy. So, in effect, this is a way of making those debts go away after 5 years without having to file for bankruptcy. They just become uncollectible. Yes, the rest of you can use it, but if you have a job, they're going to garnish your wages. If you have a home, they're going to file a lien against your home. Seniors may have homes, but then they take out a reverse mortgage. They get some advice on
putting it. So you're ahead of me. So I was going to say, why couldn't I do that at 53 or someone at 32?
Because someone would call WGN and say, hey, Bertrand hasn't paid his Visa bill for the last 6 months, and we would like to...
It's been four, by the way.
4 months, sorry. Okay, then you're probably clear.
Okay.
They're going to garnish your wages.
Wait,
let me just say it again. DebtCouncil.net or 800-992-3275, 800-992-3275. It sounds like a commercial. I guess it is, but I don't know anybody who's helping. But you have to be seniors or disabled on a fixed income. They will help you get out from under your creditors.
Excellent. Terry Savage, nice to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Let's stay for after the show. We'll have a little watching party.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
No, let's not. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business is in the studio, joins us most Wednesdays. Frank, welcome back. You found your way, didn't get wet, all of that?
Yeah, stayed dry.
So let's talk pizza. My favorite pizza, Lou Malnati's. Family-owned business, family-owned and grown, right where they got 42 stores, I think, now.
Right.
And
46.
46. It was a week ago. It was 42, maybe. And a whole lot of cash now. What's this about?
Yeah. So, and to your point, expansion is what it's all about. The Malnati family has sold a significant stake, Peter Frost of Cranes is reporting, to Byron Trott's BDT Capital Partners, which is a Chicago-based private equity firm. And they will have multiple seats on Lou Malnati's board. The Malnati family is still going to be involved. Mark Malnati, he's co-owner and chairman, said he will remain chairman. And his brother, Rick Malnati, will remain the company's two largest individual shareholders. So what it means is they've got cash now to expand while reducing his and his brother's individual
risk. Right, so they can expand their footprint a little bit without worries about losing the family business.
Exactly. You could get overextended.
And so they're already, they've always been in this area, but I think they've moved into Phoenix recently.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest stories at ChicagoBusiness.com a couple weeks ago when they announced that they were going to do a Phoenix location.
And they expect to expand there gradually, right? 8 or 10 stores maybe?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this infusion of cash is going to allow them to look at other markets maybe. I mean, Florida might make some sense. Anywhere where Chicagoans tend to go, right, you know, at some point.
Nashville?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder about that then. So will there, because, you know, I've been to Denver and other places where they have quote-unquote Chicago hot dog stands where you go and you get the Italian beef. And so there's got to be a point where that starts to appeal to expats,
right?
But then it has to grow its own audience too.
Exactly. So yeah, there'd have to be some probably marketing push behind it, to your point, to get that Lou Malnati's brand out to people that haven't experienced it. They got a great product though. So
oh, they have a great product. It's we had a pizza last week at my house, in fact. Yeah, so there's that, and they want to expand. They're going to go into Indiana, I know, in Wisconsin. But Malnati, Mark also says something interesting, that just because they've got a lot of cash now, it doesn't mean that they're going to expand. They're not going to overextend. I mean, they've always been a pretty gradual company when it comes to expansion.
They're prudent about it. And if you look at you know, some of the other local plays, we have a certain beef stand that recently sold and is expanding greatly, just down in River North there.
Yeah.
And
it's coming to a town near me.
Exactly. So, you know, it is seeming to be a pattern that private equity is now looking into these very smartly grown, you know, prudently grown, great products backing them up. You know, as investment opportunities.
Well, I think really it is our gift to the world. Chicago's gift to the world would be to expand Malnati's.
Yeah. Well, let's just forget this segment. Let's just call
they're selling
pizza.
They're selling Garrett's popcorn in Dubai. I learned that last week. I had them coming in, so Malnati's can't be far behind. Tell me about this Metra story. You know, I've been driving for the past year or so, but I used to be a big Metra guy. Can I just give you a little beef? You know, Union Station, they just opened up this great new transit center. You aware of that?
With
the buses
absolutely,
and everything.
Right.
You ever over there? I don't know if you are.
Yeah, I've seen it.
All right, so I took the train a couple days last week. I thought, this is going to be great. I can now wait under shelter if it's raining. So what they have under the shelters are all the bus routes that no one takes. And the 120, I'm not kidding, the 121 where there's a bus every 5 or 10 minutes still is on the street. It's just mind-boggling to me.
They figure the three people who are taking the less used routes are going to be waiting longer.
I think what it's turned into is a bus park. So they can park these buses there and keep running the 121s on the street, which is just really public service. Okay, so, but on the other end...
What's your beef, Jaylen? Do you remember those segments?
On the other end, though, Metra's working with, I don't know, is it Uber or Lyft or some rideshare company?
Yeah, so terms and company not disclosed yet, but Metra is in negotiations with a ride-sharing partner. So this partner would give Metra some cash, and in exchange for the cash infusion, Metra would become a big marketing partner for this ride-sharing, whether it's Uber, Lyft, or, you know, the one you and I are going to start after we go have some pizza.
Yeah.
that's
going to be sick.
They're trying to make two things with this. They're trying to make Metra more attractive to reverse commuters who may go out to the suburbs and then say, well, how the hell do I get to this office in Schaumburg or whatever? And so that last mile problem. So they want to,
which is a great point. I mean, I know there are pace bus routes and things like that, but, you know, it's just the volume's not there.
Exactly.
So say you pull into Lake Cook Road and you need to get a ride across the spur to Underwriters Laboratory or something like that.
Right.
You could set up to where, well, let's just say Uber for the, it might be Lyft, but to where there's a car waiting for you when the train comes in and will take you every day to your workplace.
Exactly. So you could set that up and you can have your commute solved. So this, they, the rideshare companies feels great marketing. And on Metra's end, the second thing they want to do, Metra wants to bring in more revenue so it can, you know, increase its service, decrease costs, that kind of thing. And they're also trying to add more Wi-Fi to more cars as an add-on to this as well. So there's a couple of things Metra's doing to try to improve life for commuters.
I like that. So because you'd be using Wi-Fi presumably to call your Uber or
that
Lyft.
Makes sense, right?
So to have more Wi-Fi in cars. Well, let's hope they do that because that might I might get back on Metra if I have Wi-Fi, even if I do have to wait outside for the most popular route for all commuters in the CTA.
Well, at least the weather's always good here.
That's the point, isn't it? They built these shelters. No one's going to be under. I could not believe it when I went over there last week. I'm walking up and down the sheltered routes. And I'm like, there's no 2121. It's on the street.
When I used to take the red and brown lines commuting, I just couldn't believe when they would turn the heat lamps off and how long they would wait to turn them on for the season.
Like, yeah.
The season was like, we're going to turn them on January 1st to February 15th, you know? So, yeah, there are some things that the public transit agencies seem to be a little divorced from reality.
I hope there's an explanation because it's just mind-boggling to me. Okay, we talked, I think, earlier, maybe on Friday, I don't remember, Monday maybe, Wilson Sporting Goods moving out of the northwest corner of the city and into downtown. Now, I'm not quite sure I understand this one. I tend to see Mayor Emanuel looting the suburbs and bringing a lot of businesses in Chicago. But
right.
This is one, Wilson Sporting Goods, they already had 400 jobs up on the northwest side. They are now relocating down to the Prudential Tower.
Yeah, 130 East Randall.
Is that for Wilson or the city or who?
Well, Wilson says that they're excited to, you know, for instance, be testing their equipment at like the East Bank Club for tennis and Grant Park softball field for softball. It's easier to access real life people playing and doing. So, you know, I'm sure there were some nice tax incentives as well, nice expense offset.
Well, that's what I wonder, because they are just taking it out of one part of the city and putting it into the other.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so maybe not. Maybe, you know, I don't mean to be at all cynical, because Wilson does make some great gear.
They do. They were in here a few weeks ago with their new volleyballs.
Yeah, so Prudential Plaza is, you know, a little... they're looking for tenants right now. It's a seller's market for them, so there probably was a good lease deal.
Okay, and the idea is that, you know, we've seen a lot of companies like that move downtown to try to get some hipper sort of personnel, right? It's more attractive to younger people who want to work downtown.
That's kind of the McDonald's model as well. They feel that to get millennial workers, the creative class, they should be downtown with public transit and bike sharing and all that good stuff going on, culture all around. And so, yeah, I think it's a big recruitment tool.
All right, we'll see. So Wilson moving downtown. Frank Senna, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm going to have your compatriot, Dennis Rodkin, come in, I think, tomorrow. He comes in, right? No, what? Yeah, today's Wednesday. So he'll be around tomorrow to talk real estate.
Lovely guy.
When we leave any messages or everything's...
Just tell him that the answer is 6.
I will do that. no, I won't do that. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here on the Business Lunch. We're going to talk about, well, maybe your school would be your computer sitting in the corner, the future of education. Anant Agarwal is the CEO of EdX, and he joins us on a phone line now. Anant, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Oh, hi. This is Anant. Nice to be on the show, Steve.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And, I want to talk about this new sort of the MicroMasters program with the EdX. But let's back up first and just get an introduction to EdX. This is sort of the brainchild, what was it, MIT and Harvard to allow for online courses? Or tell me about EdX and its start.
Sure. EdX is a nonprofit organization. We offer some of the best courses from the best universities in the world. On our portal, edx.edx.org, and you can take these courses for free. So we were founded by Harvard and MIT about 4 years ago, and you can take courses on edX completely online for free from topics ranging from business to entrepreneurship to digital marketing to computer science to social work to the humanities, languages, and the arts. We have about 9 million students learning on our platform right now from 196 countries in multiple languages.
Now, I read that you taught the first edX course on circuits and electronics from MIT and had 155,000 students from 162 different countries.
It is a little mind-numbing. You know, on campus, I teach about 100 students each semester.
Yeah.
In what is a very, very hard course. It's a sophomore course. When we launched edX in early 2012 with the circuits course along with my colleagues, we had 155,000 students enrolled in the course from 162 countries. So it was pretty, the numbers are pretty staggering.
You know, I'm tempted to make a joke about grading quizzes, but that's a little too obvious. I won't do it. But so I could just go home tonight and sign up for a course being taught out of MIT or Harvard and then just take it on my own. Is that what you're telling me?
Exactly, and for free. So you can, whether it's MIT or Harvard or Berkeley or Tsinghua in China. So we partner with about 110 of the world's leading institutions. And you can pick a topic, go to edX.org and type in the topic in the search bar. And a bunch of courses will pop up and you can learn for free.
And so are these courses that are taught on a schedule or are they sort of you can join anytime and just follow along online?
There are a couple of approaches. Depends on the course. Some courses are what we call self-paced, and you can select the self-paced courses. Those courses are on demand, available all the time. You can start when you want and be flexible in terms of time. There are others which have a start date and an end date, and they have weekly deadlines, much like you would have at any university.
So if I choose to take a course at Stanford, but I haven't been accepted at Stanford, then I'm assuming that I can't work toward a degree at Stanford.
That is correct. So just as an example, Columbia launched a artificial intelligence and computer science MicroMasters on edX. And clearly, if you don't get admission into Columbia, you won't be able to go and get a degree there. However, you can take their programs on edX and you can learn for free. That's an amazing thing. And tens of thousands to millions of people are doing that. But if you want a credential, let's say you want a certificate, we have a certificate for each course. You pay a small fee on the order of $50.
Is the course different, or it's just you're just paying for the credential once you've completed the course?
You are paying for the credential. Okay. Along the way, you have to pay for the credential along the way, and some of the assignments, when you do some of the assignments, for example, you may be virtually proctored so that there is more integrity to the process. But the content is by and large available for free on whether you're paying for the course for a certificate or you're taking it for free.
So I want to talk about the MicroMasters, but just one more thing. So if I'm going to go home and sign up for a course at Harvard, so just at the next dinner party, I can say, well, during my class at Harvard, does that fly?
Well, you can say, I took this class taught by a Harvard professor.
This reminds me of my day at Harvard, yeah.
Day or night. I mean, the beauty of the online model is that it's not just day. You know, you can be in your pajamas, sipping your favorite drink at 3 o'clock in the morning and be learning about justice from Professor Michael Sandel at Harvard.
It's fascinating to me, and I know it's been around a few years, but there's this new development called the MicroMasters program, which is a little bit maybe more tangible. Tell me about that.
Sure. So we are 4 years into this, and our learners were telling us and corporations were telling us that edX should attempt to address the skills gap, which is a gap between what learners know when they graduate from college and the kinds of skills needed for jobs in the marketplace. And we are looking to bridge that gap, and we launched the MicroMasters. The idea is that a MicroMasters is about 4 to 5 courses. It's a program of courses, and it's about the one quarter to one half of a typical master's degree on campus. But you can do this completely online on edX. As always, you can learn for free. There's no admissions requirements, no GREs, no SATs. Everybody welcome. And if you want a credential called the MicroMasters for the 4 or 5 courses, you pay on the order of, believe it or not, about $1,000. And the other thing about a MicroMasters is that Each of these are endorsed by a corporation. So, for example, we have a MicroMasters in artificial intelligence from Columbia, and endorsed by GE, where employers are saying that these are the kind of skills that they need for the kind of people that they hire.
And these MicroMasters can actually be translated into courses at the school from which you take them, right? If you decide to apply there and get accepted to get a master's degree, say, from Columbia, your MicroMasters work could actually count toward that degree.
That's the key differentiator, exactly. So you could take the MicroMasters credential and put that on your resume, post that on your LinkedIn profile. At the same time, if along the way or in the future you decide to go and get a full master's from, let's say, Columbia or MIT, then if you get admission into that program, then the MicroMasters will convert into credit on campus. So, for example, if you do the supply chain management, the MicroMasters from MIT on edX, and you get admitted into that campus program, then you can complete the campus program in half the time. In 6 months as opposed to 1 year, and at a substantial discount in terms of the overall master's program as well.
Anant Agarwal is the CEO of edX. We have to take a break, Anant, but you must be excited to be doing this. This is an exciting venture.
I mean, it is extremely exciting, and I think the MicroMasters finally can tackle the skills gap. I think it can also help us tackle now the huge student debt that we have,
$1.5 billion. Excellent. Well, good luck to you. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be on, Steve.
You bet. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.